I know when I open my mouth, you know I'm not from this neck of the woods. When I first came down here 3 years ago, I got the title of Damn Yankee pretty fast. But I had no control over that any more than I did of my alcoholism. But I'm very grateful that I have both under control now, because I am a member of AA, and I have been a resident of the South for 3 years in Lubbock. My name is Pete Washer. I am an alcoholic. I'm not very anonymous. I want to express my deepest gratitude to you people. And I want to express this from not only myself, but from my very lovely and dear wife, because bringing us here, you have given us something that we have needed very badly. When Monty said last night that when this group started for their first affair, I believe it was a one-day affair, they discovered the need for new meat, some new blood. And you know, this was the situation that we were in. Living up in Cleveland, Tennessee, and it's been some time since we have attended the conference, and both of us need some new meat and some new blood. And we found it here, and it's been wonderful. And I'm so thankful to have the privilege to be up here this evening in front of you. I would like to, I feel something like the story that Courtney told me yesterday. He said that somebody got up in front of some meeting. A member got up and said, "Ladies and gentlemen," nothing came out. "Ladies and gentlemen," long pause. Finally he said, "When I came here tonight, God and I knew what I was going to say. Right now only God does." I'm kind of in the same boat. Because when I got this invitation several months ago, and this is a mistake, I think, I had several beautiful talks all planned. Oh, they were wonderful. I enjoy every one of them. I've had the fortune, good fortune, to have been in this program a little over 17 years. This is only important to me, and of course to my wife. It's the proudest possession that I have today, and I always hope that I'll always keep it in that place. It's got to come first. You see, through the years, I was one of these lucky guys that have been active in this program, and I've stayed with it. When we first came to Cleveland, Tennessee, we had a member come into our new group. He was a controller of a large organization there. Had a very serious alcoholic problem. Been hospitalized many, many times. The company had done everything to take care of him. And yet the president of this company, because this fellow told me this when he came in, the president of this company said, "You've got to do something about your drinking." But he says, "Don't get hooked up with AA. Because if you ever do, you're hooked for life." I'm very grateful that I've been hooked to this program for life. And I hope I'll always be hooked to it. It's a little difficult for me to go back and tell my story. In fact, of late, I would much rather tell what happened to me, how I've lived this program, and what it's meant to me. I could qualify, but I'm going to say to you that tonight, you just take my word for it. And if anybody wants to really know my story, I can tell them how to get a hold of it in a very easy and quick way. So tonight, if you'll let me, I want to say what happened to Pete Watson since he's been in AA. I particularly want to get this across to the new member too, because coming into AA is not just a bed of roses. Magic wand. Oh, I know what it was like the first few months I was in. I was on this wonderful cloud nine. But a lot of things have happened to me. A lot of wonderful things. A lot of rough things, too. But for this program, doing it one day at a time has pulled me through every single incident. So, bear with me and let me tell you a few of the incidents that have happened since I came into this program. Now, don't get me wrong here, because I've had that years of experience, that I'm any Mr. AA. Any old bleeding deacon loves that title. But there ain't no such animal in this organization. We're not experts either, because from what you hear from me, if there's something you like and it rings a bell, I've heard it from somebody else. We often get up here and say, this is, remember, these are my opinions, not necessarily AA. My experiences are my own, but often when I say something, it's the opinion of some good AA that I was fortunate enough to hang on to in the early days, because I liked what he had. And he had a few years of sobriety and backup. And I thought, that's the guy, or that's the person, or persons that I want to hitch my wagon to. I came into this program by a telephone call. Nobody drove me into it. I voluntarily came in. And I want to tell you a couple of stories, because this AA business is so serious with me that I haven't got much of a funny story to tell. I can tell you some few, very acute instances, and these are a couple of them. Just mentioning the word that couple of sponsors that came and gave me the message and the voluntary part of the program. We have a very well-known character actor. You've all seen him on TV, and maybe you've seen him on the stage. And up in New York, I have had the privilege of hearing him give his first lead. He'd only been in AA a couple of months, and he was just bubbling over with joy, you know. He was sober, and the world just looked wonderful to him. This particular meeting was the After Hours Club in New York. And this is where most of the theatrical people and the stagehands and the producers come. It starts at 12:30 in the morning. And they have a lot of speakers, and at this point, you get about 5 minutes. Well, this guy got up and told of his experience, and this is what happened to him when he made the call. He was at the end of the rope, desperate, couldn't lay off the stuff, sick, shakes, sweating, and he picked up that phone pleadingly, like I did. I did the very same thing. I remember calling with the tears rolling down my cheeks. I wanted help. I said, sit tight, we'll send a couple of fellows over to you. This fellow said, if you can, stay away from the drinks. We'll send members over to talk to. Just hang tight. So he was pacing the floor back and forth, wondering when they were ever going to get there. There's a knock at the door, and another famous character actor, Titan, you've seen him too, was standing there. And this guy says, "Come on in, Louis." He says, "I'm waiting for a couple of sons of bitches from AA." Louis says, "I ain't these sons of bitches from AA." I think that's one of the classics in this program. And the voluntary part I'll never forget. I said that I came into this program voluntarily. There's a very dear friend of mine came into this program just a few months after I did. He tells this story. He was in his early days, and like so many of us, you know, we get all full of that enthusiasm, and we just want to dry up everybody we know. And we used to make all kinds of calls. We said in those days we used to keep our pants hanging on the end of the bedstead in case we got a call we could run right out. Well, he got one, and it was down in Pittsburgh, in the steelworkers district, where there were mostly Czechoslovakians, the foreign element. He walked up to the door, and Miss Alan Gallagher, if you ever heard him, says, "Well," his wife came and says, "It's upstairs." And my good friend Steve goes up there, and the little woman following him. And he looks at this guy, the bed shaking, the room shaking, he's shaking. Sweat pouring off of him. And Steve is giving them both barrels. Giving them the works. Not thinking in too much. Not getting much replies. And finally he says, "You know, this is a voluntary program." The little woman had been very quiet all this time. She says, "Don't worry, I'll see the sons of bitch volunteers all right." So that's the way I came in. Two fellas came and brought me the message. And I wanted this program. Well, what's happened to me since? I found I had an awful lot to learn, as we all do. And thank goodness I'm still finding that out today. One of the first things I had to learn, heard about, was honesty in this program. You know, the program used to say in the preamble, "Have an honest desire to stop drinking." We now say, "Have a sincere desire to stop drinking." This honesty is pretty tough, you know. But the toughest part of it is being honest with, that I have, is being honest with Pete Wasser. I never realized how important this part of this program was. I was in it 3 months, happy. I'd lost my wife, she was back. I had sobriety. I was 2-7, number one and number 12, period. Oh, I'd make couple of trips out of town. Hadn't bothered me. I can remember the first one I went to was Washington, D.C. I think I'd been in the program about a month. And I was so excited because somebody said, "We have a guest from Pittsburgh, we'll get up and say a few words." Well, this is never any problem to me in any bar or anywhere else. Just let me around and let me ask me anything and I get up and talk forever. But this happens to me in an AA meeting. I'm so excited that I get on the phone and have to tell my wife. And then she says afterwards, "The minute I get on the phone," even said 8 hours, she knew everything was all right, just when I said hello. You know what it is, fast. I don't know how, but you could just smell it over the telephone. So I'd had a few out-of-town trips, and I came in this program in June, on June 15, 1945. I'm down in New York in September, got in the morning, this was during the war, did my business, stayed over one night, got up the next day, had that business done, handled, everything going along fine. All I had to do was catch the midnight train home. I'm walking down Fifth Avenue and I run into a very, very old dear friend of mine. Hi, Pete. Hi, Johnny. When'd you get in? Oh, I got in yesterday. Florence here? No. Well, Queenie, that was his wife, is in town. What do you say we have dinner together tonight? Fine. What are you saying? I told him. He said, well, I'll be up about 6 o'clock, 6:30, have the bourbon and water ready. He was a bourbon drinker, but not an alcoholic, and this is my favorite when I could get it. I said, I sure will, Johnny. Now, all I had to say to that guy right then and there was, I'm off of it. I could have even said, which I did later, a couple of years later, Johnny, I'm a member of AA now. I've cut it out. Because, as he told me later, hitting me on the back, is that the best thing you ever did? But I didn't say that. I said, sure. Come on up. Now, the reason was that I know now, I didn't think I came into this program with any reservations, but I had them. I was healthy, had my wife back, had a wonderful job, everything's going good. Why not a drink? I could see that halo over my head. So I didn't even think about it. I thought, well, this is a good time. I think I'll do a little research. Never did like this word slip. So I didn't go very far. You don't have to in New York, and a bar was there. And I walked in and I said, may I have a shot, bourbon, single. Oh, I was proud of this. A single one and a little water chaser. Tossed it off, paid for it, walked out proudly, and I thought, well, this isn't hard. Of course, there were quite a few bars between there and the hotel. And when I got up to the hotel, I ordered the bourbon all right, not in a few shots, I ordered a couple of bottles. And when Johnny's wife came up, I was more than sociably drunk, let's put it. I was still on my feet. Now, when I left that room and went for the train, I stopped and had my last one at the Tavern Bar there in Pennsylvania Depot. And here's was a good break for me. The good Lord was looking after me, because I got on that train, and this was during the war when the club cars were closed at 10 o'clock. And I'm sure that this porter was a lay minister, because I couldn't buy one of those stinking little 1 1/8 ounces for $5, 10, I even offered 20 for it. And he wouldn't part with one of them. There wasn't anything else for me to do but climb in bed, plastered, and try to sleep it off. So I got up in Pittsburgh the next morning with a hangover, a new one that I had never experienced before. I'd had hangovers, but this is a different kind. Here I was in AA. I had found what I wanted. I had my wife back. I had a lot of wonderful friends. And of course, in those days, the first thing that I thought, gee, if I let them down. It took me a long time to realize how much I'd let myself down. I went to the office. I was very fortunate that I was my own boss. I signed some payroll checks. I sat around. I couldn't get this off my mind. I think I went up to one of these boiling hot baths, had the hot water on me and the cold. Went home, and I thought, what am I going to do about this? I knew one thing I was going to do about it, I was going to get back to AA. And as usual, I got this wonderful welcome. I got to the door, and how was the trip? And I said, fine, dear. Was you busy? Everything going along? Everything went along wonderful. I thought, I've got to tell her about this. We went through dinner, and I didn't say a word. And I thought, well, let's wait till after dinner. It'll be easier. I thought, maybe while we're drying the dishes, I'll tell her then. Didn't do it. Got back into the living room. I picked up the evening paper, and I don't know whether it was upside down or right side up. She was reading a magazine, and I thought, well, now I'm going to do it. About that time, she opened her mouth and said, honey, if you ever took a drink, would you tell me? I said, I sure would, dear, and just shut up like a clam. So, I went back to AA. And with a new life, I decided maybe they really got something that these fellows talk about, that if you want to take a drink, you better cut it out. You can never take another one. And so I got real busy. I really got into this 12-step work. I was lucky again. I ran into a fellow that I hadn't seen for a great many years, 20-some-odd years. He just came into the program, and he liked it so well that he decided he was going to dry up everybody in Allegheny County, and I decided I'd help. So I really got my feet wet. As time went on, came around a year from that June that I went in, and we're sitting here at dinner one night, and Florence says, you know, this is your birthday. I said, my birthday? I just had my natal birthday 3 or 4 days ago. I said, what do you mean this is my birthday? Did you know this is your AA birthday? It's been 1 year, maybe 1 year ago, and you know what you do. And in our group, they had a little party for the new man. That first year was a big one. So the course, they'll have the usual ice cream and cake for you. I thought, oh, brother, they got me now. So I thought, well, what am I going to do? And I always like to say that I had the battle of the gremlins, and I really had them. The good gremlins and the bad ones. The good gremlins was whispering in my ear and say, remember, this is an honest program. You better come clean, Keith. The bad gremlin was saying, keep your mouth shut, the damn fool. Nobody knows a thing about you. And this went on back and forth. I thought, well, I've got to tell my wife. So I was going to tell her, and I thought, well, I'll tell her when we get on the way up to the church. It's only about 5 minutes to the church. I think we got to the church before we even got out of the house, because the next thing I know, we're in the church. I haven't said a word. And in those days, our meeting place was, we had to walk by a little sort of back through a little kitchen to get to the meeting room in the basement of this church. And there on the table was my birthday cake. My wife opens her pocketbook, takes out a 10-cent store angel, and plants it right in the middle of it. This is a big help. Well, I don't know who the speaker was. I remember who the chairman was, but I can't tell you for life me who the speaker was. Because I knew what was going to happen. They're going to say, this is Pete's birthday, and I wish to come up and say a few words. And the doggone gremlins are still battling with me. Remember, Pete, this is an honest program. Come clean. Don't be a damn fool, Pete. Nobody knows about this. Well, they asked me. Now, I got up there, and here again was guidance. I said, I'm sorry. I'm not a year old today, I'm only a 9 months old baby. And there, for the first time, I really understood what they meant by the honesty of this program. I just can't tell you the relief that came over me. I didn't realize that for that 9 months, what a load I was carrying. The shackle fell off. And here a whole new, I thought I was happy. Hey, I was. But here a whole new world opened up to me the minute I got rid of that lie I was carrying around. You know, they say, I heard one man express this very well. To get this program, this is a pretty tough one. When you have one clean hand and one dirty one. And I believe. I think we're confused enough when we come in here. And I can recall very vividly, in my early days, a very fine dentist in Pittsburgh. And he couldn't get this program. He tried and he tried. And I know now it's because he had just one clean hand and one dirty one. And I've seen it happen so often. The next thing I had to learn about this program was what they meant by the spiritual part of it. Sure, I believe in God. I believe in the Lord's Prayer. If I said it, it was just, well, we're just saying it, that's all. No understanding, no reason why. I just, that was the thing to do. If you said the Lord's Prayer, say it, and I said it. And it took me about 2 to 3 years before I woke up to the fact that what some of these fellows were saying about the spiritual part of this program, they had something. But I was missing something. You see, I had my sobriety, I had a good job, everything was going fine, I had my wife, and I just, what more did I need? Then when things got a little rough, as they will to all of us, and I heard them say what they got out of the Serenity Prayer, oh, I used that, yes, but I haven't really analyzed it. I never really analyzed the Lord's Prayer. As a matter of fact, let me say this, but I think some of the other old-timers here remember it. So when I first came in AA, and I don't ever understand this to this day, because the word, because of our 12 steps, how many times God has mentioned in it, but it was sort of played down, it was hush-hush. Don't talk about it too much, you might scare somebody out. And actually, I think in those early days that I kind of thought that anybody stood up and talked about God, that he was, sort of a panty waist and heavy. How wrong I was. Because without the spiritual part of this program, I can tell you honestly that I wouldn't be here today. It's pulled me through so many, many times. Now, I'm not what you'd call a real religious man in the eyes of the church. Maybe the best way I can explain my religion is another incident that happened to us. We just built a new home in Pittsburgh. I just moved into a very lovely home. And a new district, and the various members of the cloth came around to see what church, or if they could drum up a little business. And I think this used to get a little embarrassing to my wife, because in this one particular case, let's say, a young Presbyterian minister who I got to know very well afterwards, he didn't mince any words. He finally came to the point and says, well, by the way, what church does your husband belong to? And she said, well, I guess his religion is Alcoholics Anonymous. His remark was that I don't know of a finer one. Now, maybe I'm rationalizing, I don't know. But let me say that I have found an understanding. I have been able to grasp more with you people. And a better understanding of God than I ever did in church. This is not the church's fault, this was probably my fault. When I go to a church, it doesn't make any difference today whose church I go to. In the early days of this program, when I found out how important the spiritual part of it was, when things got rough with me, I could overcome that present situation. The situation I was in, if I just walked into the first church I came to, and I didn't care whose church it was, sit down in the back row, do what they say in that 11th step. And usually I could pick up the hymnal and somewhere find in there the 23rd Psalm. And I can tell you honestly, it had never failed to overcome a crucial situation, which I thought was the crucial. It really wasn't, because what I was doing was reverting back to my old self. I was trying to run things my way, not God's way. And when I do that, I'm in trouble. I've got to always remember, if thy will be done. We had a very wonderful Al-Anon gal visit us long ago, and I think she put it in about the easiest way to understand as I've heard. She expressed the same thing, that she could get in trouble when she was trying to do it her way and not God's way. He said, you know, I got to the point where I have a problem, I hang it up in the hook and say, God, there it is. You take care of it. He said, as long as I leave it up in that hook, I'm all right. But when the minute I pull it back down, try to handle, I get in trouble. And I found this so. I couldn't get along without the Serenity Prayer. Oh, I'll try to kick it around a little, you know, this word wisdom. Wisdom knows the difference. There's where we alcoholics can really rationalize. And I'm still capable of doing it. And I catch myself doing it. If I get sincere about it, I really know the difference. I know that I gotta have the courage to change the things I can. Humility. There's a tough one. This is the hardest one, one of the hardest things I have to practice today. Of course, I don't think any honest guy, I don't care whether it's AA or non-AA, if he ever says he's got that one licked, why, if an alcoholic says he's got that one licked, look out. He's going to take off in orbit. What I'd like to sort of express humility is, today, as I see it, is to be thankful for what I am and not resentful for what I am not. And grateful for what I have and not hateful for what I haven't got. And I heard another very wonderful expression of humility. We talk about the 12 steps. There's our program, it's all there. And actually, we express it that we're climbing those steps to sobriety. Well, when you analyze it, we've been in this program some time. Are we climbing in sobriety, or are we walking down into humility? You know, one of the things that alcoholics have is a short memory. I think we have the shortest memory in the world. I say this because I see too many of us get away from this program. It hurts me to see members that have been in AA for some time found their sobriety, and then they don't come back. Of course, this is their privilege. We're grateful that they're sober. More than anything else, when I say this short memory, I've heard many of them get up and say, I owe my life to AA. Yes? They do. But yet, I'm going to talk to some of these older members. We miss you. Why don't you come back? Well, they've got all mixed up with things. They've got their church. They've got their bowling nights. They've got their Rotary Club. They have this and that. And I just stop and wonder. They didn't have any of those things when they came into AA. They have them all now. That's that short memory. And I think another thing that bothers me a little, of course, you know, we bleeding deacons always have a right to gripe a little. I think another one of the things that bothers me, too, is the wives. I'm very fortunate. My wife came into this program. She's not an alcoholic. But she came in when I did. Shortly after I did. When I got her back, that's it. And we've been going together to conferences. We've been to AA meetings all over the United States, and I can even say in Europe. I love her. Remember, Father Payton said that the family that prays together stays together. In my book, the man and wife to go to AA together stay together and stay in AA. How many times have any of you fellows called on a pigeon? And the wife will say to you, I'd give in anything in the world if John would get sober. Anything. I'll do anything. Get all wrapped up, come along, all enthusiastic, about a year, to disappear. What's happened? Well, she's back in the bridge club. Her husband now belongs to a country club. She's playing golf. She's doing this or that. Why don't you come around? Her husband needs her, or vice versa. Having a little trouble. She doesn't understand it. Yet that was the gal that said, I'd give anything in the world if John would stop drinking. Those little things are a little hard for me to still swallow. I'm doing my best to practice commerce on them. Let me tell you a few things about
business affairs.
Oh, brother.
How AA can help you there? I haven't been in this program but about a year. I was general manager of a radio station in Pittsburgh, making very fine money and on a good bonus. Came around for renewing that, and they said, we want to cut this bonus down a little. Well, you know how that hurts. And I just thought I was doggone important. I've been sober too. Oh no, they're never going to let me go. But they did. And I'm out in the cold without a job. Well, I'd also had a pretty good reputation. I thought it was going to be a cinch to get another job, but it wasn't a cinch. Not knowing what to do, I just decided to open up an advertising agency. I opened up in one room. I put my wife back to work. She'd been retired, but I brought her back. And along about this time, I got mixed up with a very famous name in networks, making $3,250 a week. And he got drunk and lost his job. And he came to Pittsburgh. And I happened to meet him and know him. Got him into AA. And while I didn't have any advertising accounts except one little one, got the bright idea that we'll put this fellow on transcriptions, and I knew something about that business and sell them to the station. But we started. I'm starting on a shoestring. I get involved into thousands and thousands of dollars with the National Broadcasting Company, the union and the musicians union and writers and so forth and so on. We got these transcriptions for 15 minutes with this well-known name. So I'm running out of money. I've got to get them sold. And I heard the Gulf Oil Company were looking for a 15-minute show. 5 days a week across the board, and this is a big package, believe you me. So I hopped on a train, went down to New York, went to the advertising agency, told them we had it. They said, "Who you got?" And I told them, he said, "We wouldn't touch that guy with a 10-foot pole." I said, "Well, you don't have to worry. He's in AA, and I got him on the records." Well, that made a little sense to him. So we were to have the audition. They agreed to it. Sounded pretty good. And he said, "You bring so-and-so down, you come down here, and we'll talk it over." I was to be there on a Monday morning. My boyfriend says, "Look, I think I'll go down for the weekend. I haven't been down for quite a while. I want to look up some of my old friends." I said, "Fine." Oh, brother. I got in Monday morning, pick up the phone, call him, and the babe answers the phone. This is good. He gets on. He says, "That's all right, Pete. You know, I'm all right. Nobody's seen me. I've been right around, and it's all right. I'll be all right. No, GM, I'm sick. I don't know what to do. I've got the appointment that afternoon. I don't know anything else to do but pace up and down the street, and I finally go into my favorite old haunt in New York. God bless the bartender, he remembered me there, because I've been going there quite a few years since I've been AA, and he said, "Hi, Mr. Wasser, do you want your favorite?" And I said, "Yes, I do." And this favorite was what he called a ginless Ricky. This was my drink. Lime, squeezed in, Canada Dry on top of it. So I tossed off two or three of those. And who walks in but the head of the advertising agency that had this appointment with him? He says, forget the appointment. I says, what do you mean, forget it? He says, your boyfriend was up here Friday. He made a mess of things. There you are. He didn't even know he'd been there. So this is how this venture. I got back down and out, busted, all kinds of bills, a sheriff on my neck, and yet, look what happens. The one little account we had to start this advertising agency was a Jewish advertising dentist. He advertised Dr. So-and-so, the dentist you can trust, and he trusts me. And I had become friendly with him because he had a pretty good size account. I'd become friendly with him. He never could quite understand it because my father was what you'd call an ethical dentist. Oh, Lord, you mentioned an advertising dentist, he'd have a fit, John. Fit. But he would have problems, and every once in a while he'd call me up, and he couldn't understand why I talked to him. I said, well, you're a good client, and you do dentistry for the poor. And I said, I'm not against you. We became quite close friends. He drops in the office one day just to see how we're getting along. Well, I say we're in this about 8x8 office. We're sitting there. Florence is with her head down, not knowing what to do. I am in there. And he walks in and says, what's the matter? This is like a morgue. I said, I think we're just about out of business. He said, what do you mean you're out of business? Well, I told him a little about it. He said, you still got a roof over your head? And I said, yes. He said, you're still eating? I said, yes, we're still eating. He said, the only advice I can give you is keep punching. As long as you're punching, they can't hit you. That sounded right. Now, I said, get the books out and let's take a look at this, see how bad a shape you're in. Got them out, and he said, oh, well, you're in pretty bad shape. But he says, a few dollars, you can make it. Walks out the door. In a few minutes, and then an hour, he's back and he puts an envelope on the table. And we open it up, and there's several thousand dollars in that envelope in cash, believe it or not. I think my wife started to cry, I think I did, and I handed it back to him. I said, Doc, you don't want the investment in this company. This is because it's a doggone foreman. He says, I'm not making an investment in the company, I'm making an investment in you and Florence. Take that and keep punching. He walked out the door. I took him over a note for this amount plus interest, at 5% interest. It was probably 2 or 3 years. I used to see him, he'd never say a word to me. My business started to grow. And one day, Florence says, you know, we got the money to go over and pay the Doc. I said, write it up. This is a big day. I walked into his office with that check and the 5% interest. And he looked at me and I looked at him. A couple of tears came down his cheeks and came down mine too. I don't mind telling you. He looked at the check and tore it up. He says, now look, I told you I wasn't investing in your company. I was investing in you. Now go back and make me out of that check without the interest. There's one of the incidents that happened. Do you think that would ever happen to me if I'd been drinking? Not in 1,000 years. Oh, that's just one of the rewards. I think the greatest reward we get out of this program is carrying the message to others. I've heard people get up and say, they cry about the ones they've lost. I don't know how many I've lost. I have many ideas. I don't think about those. I'd much rather think about the ones that have made the program. And let me tell you a couple of stories. Because these are the things that keep me going, that keep me ticking in this program. I guess I'd been in the program about 7 or 8 years. Got a call to set up a AA meetings we could in Woodville. I stopped at a Pittsburgh State Institution. And with some problems and so forth, we got this meeting started. That's the first meeting that came down there. It was really rough. We had it all mixed up with those that had a wet brain and mental patients, and this was hard. And it took a little patience with the doctors and the nurse to separate those. And when we finally got it down to pure alcoholics, they were all men except one lone gal, Mary Lou. She'd come in there and she'd sit in the back, never say anything. Really a sad case. Hold her head down. I'd go over and talk to her and try to encourage her. Never got anywhere. Found out she'd been in there several years. Finally, I said to Florence, you come over. See if you can reach this girl. And she did, and Florence had a very wise message to her. He said, look, talk to her. He said, you know, Mary Lou, maybe the best thing you could do would be to, you've been here a long time, go around and help others. You see them coming in, encourage them. They need help. And from that very day on, meeting on, this was a new gal. She came in there smiling, spoke to everybody. And I thought, well, this girl doesn't belong here anymore. And I went to my good friend, the doctor, a woman doctor, Dr. Holland. And I said, what can we do and what can happen and how can we get Mary Lou? She's been in here over 3 years or over. She's as normal, I think, as I am. Does she have to stay here? And she said, well, this is a rough proposition. She is assigned in here, and you're going to have to get the mother and father's release. Well, where do they live? They told her. So on a Sunday afternoon, Florence and I jumped in the car and went over in McKeesport. Came up to this house, the windows were all down to the foreign section. Rapped on the door opened a little ways. A woman came out, stuck her nose to the door, and we said, may we see you? Well, what about? We said, we want to talk to you about Mary Lou. With that, the door almost went closed. She looked around, she whispered, and said, come on in. We went to this very neat, clean house. You could eat off the floor. So when we mentioned that name, she said, she can never come back here. I said, you mean you never can have her back here? She said, no. It's kind of my husband and the other children. You see, Mary Lou had been such a drunkard. She had disgraced the neighborhood. The brothers and sisters had been pointed at that there is so-and-so, her sister is a drunk. She had thrown herself in front of a train. She jumped off the bridge. Everything had happened to her. Well, I said, what are you going to do about it? Nothing. And she was crying a little too, because we have told everybody that Mary Lou is dead. Well, we went out of there. Both of us a little dejected. But I went back to my good friend, the doctor, and I said, now what do we do? She said, well, be patient. We'll have to write 2 registered letters. If they come back and no answer, then we'll sit down and talk about it. The letter was written, and she called me and said, now, Mary Lou can go, but you will have to be responsible. You will have to be responsible. I said, wait a minute. About her sobriety? Never. I don't even guarantee my own. No, she said, not about that. She understood that. But we'll have to have a report twice a year for the next 3 years. She's going to have a home, and she's going to have a job. Well, it's just about this time, this seemed like quite a large order. We knew from our past home that bringing her home, she'd be a little out of place. But thanks to Florence, Florence found her home. The job part, I took the bull by the horns and went to my next door neighbor, who had a pretty good sized company. I said, John, I heard you mention trouble that you had getting girls. By the way, this girl had one time worked for the Bell Telephone Company. She could operate a tantometer and all the various machines. I said, I've heard you say you had trouble with girls getting them. He said, it's the biggest headache I got. I said, I've got one for you. I want to tell you your history. I told her every bit of it. He says, well, that's more I know about most of them. Send her down. She goes to work. Took her to a few meetings, trying to get her to go. She was a little bashful about that. She never wanted to go back up to Woodville. I think she had a fear that she'd be locked back up in there. Things are going along pretty good, and we got her so she's going to a Carnegie meeting, which is too far away from where she lives. And one night we get that call. This is from the lady where she was staying. That Mary Lou had not come home. Oh, brother, this beautiful, you know, this is, everything's going fine, and this feeling. I had it. Where could she be? I don't know, I think it was around 11 o'clock at night or 11:30, and I got another guy, and I went down. I knew all the haunts down around near the bus station, and I made every one of them, but I couldn't find her. 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the morning, I'm in bed. She calls. Tells us. Well, it was a great relief. I got a hold of her again. I said, kiddo, we're going to meetings. Where are we going tonight? We're going back to Woodville. She broke down. She thought I was putting her back in the state hospital. I said, no, Mary Lou. I'm not putting you back there. This is the closest meeting tonight. Let's just go back. Well, she got into the program then. And then one day, she met a fella in AA. Mike, a little older than she was, and I knew Mike. I heard they were going together. Phone rings and said, Pete, Mary Lou and I want to come out and see you tonight. I said, fine. I hung up the phone. I said, Florence, you and I have just become a father and mother. I know what's going to happen tonight. So she came out, and they did, and of course she went and asked her for her hand. And would I be the best man, or would I give her away, and would Florence be the bridesmaid? I'm telling you, when that day came and we had that wedding, one of the greatest and wonderful, most wonderful thrills I've ever had. We still hear from them. Her husband works for National Steel. I've had pictures of them when they sent them down where this little Mary Lou that was put away for life is standing there at a picnic ground somewhere with the president of that steel company. And incidentally, we got another note from her not long ago. She took up painting and she won an art prize. And this is a little girl that's been put away for life. These are the rewards that, well, they're just, you just can't express them. I can't give you in words what these mean. And I've got to tell you another one, too. It happened in later life, a later time in AA. You know how reluctantly sometimes we're called upon to give a lead? You're sitting at home and you're smug and somebody calls you up and will you do this? Oh, yeah. She'd much rather look at television. Well, I got such a call one time and asked me if I'd go down to speak at the House of Hospitality. And this was the priest started a mission house, really, for Skid Row bums in an old school. He said they were starting an AA group down there, and would I please go down and talk to them? The meeting was on a Sunday afternoon, and I said, yes, I'd go. Well, Sunday came around, was cold, wet, and rainy, and I thought, oh, brother, to get out of the house today. And what have I got to say to a bunch of Skid Row bums? This is what they were. They came in and actually to this meeting, most of them, to get a cup of coffee and some donuts and get in out of the rain. I jumped in my car, I'm wondering what I was going to say when I got down there. Here I am driving up in a brand new car. I've got a white collar on, a suit of clothes, and I'm supposed to get up there and deliver a message to these people. I can tell you honestly, I don't know to this day what I said, but I know I said a little prayer. I said, "Dear God, if there's a message I have to give to them, will you please give it to me now?" And after the meeting was over, I would say there's about 50 or 60 in there. Right in the back of the room, a guy comes down the middle of the aisle. He's got one white shoe on and one black one. He's got a a week's growth. He has no coat. He's got patches in his pants. He puts his hand up, that cold, clammy hand, and breathing smoke in my... What is it, stereo? What is that stuff they drink? Sterno. I could smell it when it came down. He says, "I don't know what you got. Whatever you got, I want it." Now, this is on a Sunday. I said, "How bad do you want it?" Well, he said, "I want it bad enough to do anything you say." That's a pretty big order. I said, "Well, our central meeting is on a Friday night. Here's a couple of bucks. If you want it this bad, I'll meet you there at the Chamber of Commerce Auditorium at 8 o'clock. Out I went. I thought, well, at least the guy's got a couple of few more cans of Sterno. I went up there at 8 o'clock that night. Standing at the top of the stairs was Chuck. Bright-eyed, shaven, same clothes. Put his hand down, he says, "You didn't think I'd make it?" And I said, "No, Chuck, I didn't think you would." Well, he says, "I'm here." We went inside down at the meeting. He was about my build. I said, "Chuck, if you come around tomorrow at the office, I'll have a suit of clothes for you. An old overcoat." Chuck came up and I wasn't there. Florence was there. And she gave him the suit of clothes and the coat. This part of the story I'm going to tell, I got it from him later. He went downstairs and on the corner he ran into one of his old smoke buddies. He said, "What do you got there?" He says, "Oh, I got a suit of clothes and an overcoat." He says, "Brother, that'll get us a couple of fish." Chuck says, "You know, I thought about that for a minute." And he turned to him. He says, "No," he says, "I tried your way." He says, "I got a new way. I'm going to try this for a while." Well, we'd see him occasionally at meetings. I think by this time I loaned him about $10 or $11. I don't remember. He came in again to the office, and I wasn't there. And Florence was there. He's rattling some money in his pocket. He says, "I got a job at Duquesne University washing dishes. I'm getting $12.50 a week." He takes the buck out and puts it down on the desk and he says, "Give this to Pete." Florence says, "I don't think Pete needs it quite as bad as you do right now, so you better hang on to it." He says, "Pete may not need it, but Chuck needs to pay it." Now, this fellow at one time came from a very fine family, that old cliche. Had a good job. He didn't know where his family was. He didn't know where his wife and children were. And we decided to see if we could find him. I remember Bill Wilson was coming to talk that time. And we thought this would be a good time. And we sent a letter to the last known address and sure enough got an answer. Found a wife and she was living in a little room somewhere. And the daughter and the son. And we met over there and this was it. First time they'd been together for a long time. Chuck Lynn went on and got a job as a night superintendent. He's up and out a couple hundred dollars a month to learn to get a little room, get a little secondhand furniture. Life started all over again. Then he got back into one of his old games, and the next thing I know, he's with one of the largest selling sales promotion companies of its kind in the world. And we get a letter or a postal card about every week, and they start coming from all over the United States. And all it says on it is the number of days, and it keeps going on up. still doing it one day at a time, thanks to you. We don't see too much of Chuck because he's really gone up the line now. He's got a home in Philadelphia. They have an organ in his house. He's got two cars, and he is really tough. I wish I could give you a real happy ending to this story. I don't want to scare you. You didn't get drunk. But I got a telephone call one night. It was from the boy. He said, Dad died in the operating table under the knife for brain surgery. But I thought you'd like to know that his last words were, he wanted you to know that his 8 years in AA were the happiest years in his life, and that he was going to be buried in his AA suit. That was the suit that I'd get. I'll be forever grateful and thankful that I went to that meeting and made that lead, even if I don't know to this day what I said. But those are the rewards of this program. Those are the things that keeps Pete Wasser going. You people out there is what keeps me there. Oh, sure. Florence and I have had the privilege of, because of the former business that I was in, of knowing AAs from all walks of life, stage, screen, you name it. But what I get the most of is right down here in what I call grassroots AA. Sitting around, chewing the fat, talking over AA with you people. I like to call it the kitchen variety AA. Because after all, when I came in, we didn't have any clubs. Our social life was over a coffee, or many coffee cups, the back room. That is, the back room in the house, which was the kitchen. So this is what I found again, and what Florence found. Down here, we needed some new blood and some new meat, and we got it. And I'd like to close this little program with this one thought. What did we come in this program for? What did we seek? How did we find it? What have we found? I don't know where I got this. I picked it up from somebody in AA, but I think it expresses it, our program, Alcoholics Anonymous, so well. This is what it says. I thought my God, but my God eluded me. I sought my soul, but my soul I could not see. I sought my brother, that's you people out there, and I found all three. Good night and many thanks.